It is time to bring in David Tarachuk. It is time for the Media Beat here on Robinhood Radio. And, of course, David comes to us on a Friday morning. You can find him on his own website, themediabeat.us, also on Huffington Post. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Good to be joining you on another freezing morning. More freezing in your part of the world than mine in the media capital of the world here in New York. You've got a lot more ice than we have, I gather.
I just look, when it's freezing, it's freezing. I know I shouldn't.
But there are degrees of freezing.
I know there
you've
are.
You've got more of them than we have.
Now, as someone who writes occasionally in the Huffington Post, I have been inundated by six or seven people that write for the Huffington Post.
That's quite an inundation.
Well, they all have been told not to send in articles anymore.
Well, the Huffington Post is changing its identity, essentially, entirely, turning its back 180 degrees from where it started under the egregious Arianna Huffington. They're not even calling it the Huffington Post anymore. Have you caught up with that? Some months ago, they decided that they were no longer going to be the full name Huffington Post, especially since Arianna is not involved in the site anymore. It's been sold to Verizon. It's now a subdivision of a phone company, and it's now just known as HuffPost. I noticed you were suggesting that the temperature around you could have been raised by you talking for an hour this morning. That suggests to me that you think of your own voice as putting out hot air. Well, Huffington Post has been struggling with that issue from the beginning, because the whole idea of it was just to allow people of all descriptions, notable, not notable, professional or amateur, to get onto the site of Huffington Post and say whatever they want. It was one of the sort of first outbursts of sort of complete and unrestrained democracy of communication that distinguished Huffington Post. Now, a lot of people in the journalistic world read that rather differently and not very favorably. They say, well, this is just an opportunity for Arianna Huffington and the other co-founders of that site to get writers for free, which indeed is what it amounted to. But it's transformed over time. It's become a very valued part of the media landscape. But along with that, it started developing something called a staff. I mean, it actually had a very large, well, for many, compared to many startup websites, it had quite a substantial professional writing staff at the core of it. And that's become much more part of HuffPost, rather, identity now. And the new editor-in-chief, has decided that the very non-professionalism of it now is something to finally jettison. That distinguishing characteristic is now no longer appropriate. I believe their argument here is that in the days of fake news, when you just cannot really any longer totally justify unvetted, unprofessionally edited material to be the hallmark of your site, you may as well get rid of that. And indeed, they are going to be relying much more on the whole phalanx. They're not hiring as many people as they said they were going to hire yet, but they're certainly beefing up their professional journalistic ranks. So far, only really in Washington and New York, but the promise is that they're going to do it throughout the country. So this is a step in a reverse direction from before, in the direction now of greater professionalism.
I like what you sent along in the email to me, the cover of the New Yorker, which has a manhole, and then just the very top of Donald Trump's hair.
It's always good to play a little competition with yourself when you see those really great New Yorker covers. You say, well, what's the caption for this? And it is, of course, a perfect caption as well. Once
Who
you turn
it?
The page and see that the label for that cover is just simply "In the Hole," Fine piece of drawing, fine piece of editorial thinking, altogether.
Who's
one of the
artist?
Great New Yorker covers.
Who's the artist?
Russo, perpetually, well, perpetually, very often, very successful. Anthony Russo, a man of few lines, but the few lines are always very pointed.
All right.
Apropos, just the beginning of what is now HuffPost, which is, that'd be ridiculous, but I'm sorry.
There has the virtue of brevity, Jill, don't you think? At least that.
But the glory days of, it was actually founded right around the Wild West, Gawker, Nick Denton. I mean, they were all very much at the beginning of let's put whatever we want up there.
Armageddon.
Let's put whatever we want up there and
throw it against the wall, see if it sticks.
No, the problem was paying for it.
Well, of course, or rather, the solution was not paying for it, and then you get what you get if you don't pay for quality journalism. Quality journalism is not what you get. They wobbled for a lot, but the interesting thing is that it allowed fresh voices into the firmament, and that was very stimulating, and in the end, very good journalism did develop, and indeed. I don't know if you recall, but I now myself don't recall the name of the contributor involved, but someone who was not a professional journalist decided that she wanted to go on the Obama campaign trail, and so much so, in fact, that she mortgaged her own house with a second mortgage to pay for the travel. Not a professional journalist, but what happened to get herself on the basis of her Huffington Post platform for whatever she wrote about the campaign as she traveled, she managed to get into a semi-private meeting of Obama with supporters and donors and captured that famous quote, unwise quote from Obama talking about people clinging to their guns and religion. It was a very interesting piece of revelatory journalism, and it was done by a total non-professional. And it would only be on a source on a platform like Huffington Post that such material could happen. So it was something of a boost, something of a jigger to journalism in general. Huffington Post brought all the non-professionals in.
Did they have a legal? I'm just curious because something that people absolutely. I mean, I think you can line 10 people up, regular consumers of news, and they don't focus on the fact that whatever is broadcast has to be run by legal affairs. You know, they just don't have any idea that you can't just say what you want. And the great thing about
oh well, yes. So we see every day on social media. Yeah.
Well, right, but that was the whole thing at the beginning. Actually, was the great thing about bloggery was you could say what you wanted.
Right.
And then that
subject only to common law, which in fact started to catch people out.
Not even.
Not well. Yeah. How often was it implemented and enforced? Good question.
And that sort of developed a whole, what it always reminded me of, I mean, look, it's fun. And we know that, let's just say salacious details are far more entertaining than those stupid, dry, you know, Bureau of Labor statistics.
That's a given, yes.
Yeah, no, but it's a given. And what's happened and the great thing about what was Huffington Post, etc., was that you didn't have to really spend much time on the dry Bureau of Labor statistics, but rather you got to read what people thought about things.
Yeah, alternatively, it was the great dawning age of complete democracy of the airwaves and the Ethernet, or it was as has just been said in this little trio of our conversation, it was something of a wild west as well. But it couldn't survive that way forever, and indeed it's changing now. perhaps in the direction of greater care and greater professionalism.
But what is it going to? What does it be? What does it evolve into that we don't already have plenty of?
Well, we shall see, as our esteemed chief executive often says. We will see. My guess is that it will become another. I hope good. I mean, there are a lot of very good people at Huffington Post, and there are. It is promised that more good people will be hired. It will become another professional and dedicated piece of adventurous journalism. It's still quite adventurous, by the way. I mean, it's still getting some good scoops, and we can at least live in hope. That professionalism married to the adventurism will end up with a good product. Now, whether that product's going to be that much in demand is another question. And it was one that I was discussing here in New York with colleagues and friends. We can't be so sure of that, because that is all ultimately determined by the audience.
Right. Can I just totally change the subject for a sec?
Go right ahead.
Okay. I noticed in some news cruising that there are some stories out there just about companies and things that are happening on other places around the globe that absolutely are getting zero coverage here. And they've been going on for months. There's a big contaminated... a salmonella situation in one place. I was just stunned to see that on a very cursory almost look, that there are some big stories out there on the planet that just aren't being, they're not considered local, but they're really, you can't find them here. You really can't find them here.
Sure, the blinders that have always, I think, for many, many decades anyway, characterized American journalism, that the only thing that matters is what's going on in the United States. And then you can say that it gets even narrower entirely, that cast of view, and says it's only what happens within the beltway of Washington, D.C. matters. You can lose a lot.
Well,
go along with the main headlines of the mainstream media, and I don't want to slip into that kind of name calling that the alt-right goes in for all the time. But it is true that mainstream media in the United States is mainstream, and we know what that mainstream mainly focuses on. And it is very refreshing every now and again just to take a tour around the outposts.
See
what other people are reporting on. It's really important for us to do that.
They've never learned their lesson from the election, though. Because the mainstream media now, to get ratings and to create controversy, it really, once again, is still 24 hours a day of Donald Trump.
And just in the snapshot
of
today, whether we're going to get a government shutdown that is such an arcane and sort of narrowly focused issue that no wonder... ordinary folks, if you like, just you and me, any morning say, oh my gosh, do we have to suffer this kind of narrowly focused argument again? Is this going to be our breakfast fare every day? Well, far too often it is. The run around the outposts and just taking in some other sources every now and again is a very important antidote for us to do for ourselves as consumers.
Well, they cover news like sports. I'm sorry, it's a game, and you pick a side, and they cover it. It's ludicrous.
And it doesn't do
and then they'll throw in a story about like parents with 13 children that have been locked up.
They've been tied to a bed.
And yes, that is a news story, but then it drags on for 3 or 4 days. I mean, I don't know.
What's troubling about it is it's totally become a thing. You can get it. All of this. In quotes, news is now I'm talking about mainstream because you have the Saturday, you have a Saturday version of the morning show, Today Show. You have a Sunday version of it with a special hour and a half put aside for politics. And meanwhile, there was a big British, I think it was Brit. I mean, it could have been, I'm not positive, but Carillion. It was a really big contractor and it went completely bust at the beginning of last week. And I can't imagine that that shouldn't at least trickle into some people's consciousness, just to be aware. Or this Lactalis, this biggest or second biggest on the planet purveyor of dairy and powdered milk, salmonella. I mean, everybody makes noises about being global, and yet, and I always wonder how it is that these things manage to stay out of the news, which is, you know, really kudos to their PR departments, I think.
Well, yeah, it's an extraordinary thing that these blinders that do operate on blind us to some extraordinarily big stories. The baby formula story is vast. It's every bit as important as the 1970s and 1980s Nestle's baby formula scandal. And yet, how much play does it get in the United States? Very little. I don't want to downplay it because I'm as exercised about it as you, and I have complained about America's peculiar obsession with its own four corners and its own isolated, indeed, status in the world. Sometimes, if you cut yourself off from the world because you're the most powerful country in the world, then of course you're going to become extremely ill-informed, and that has been the nature of the American media ever since I consumed it from the other side of the Atlantic, and it's only gotten steadily worse for the vast majority of the output anyway, since I've come and been a part of it myself in the last 27 years. It's gotten more and more convinced that the only serious subjects, the only subjects worth our time devoting ourselves to are national topics and ones that are particularly eyeball-grabbing at that. Yeah. Those things that come in from the outside world that are of huge importance are always going to be down page and always at the end of the bulletin and always at the back of the paper.
Yeah, and what I find interesting is, of course, people aren't necessarily aware of where, and I'm back to food, but where their food comes from. So they don't know the subsidiaries of these basic companies. You know, it will be, I'm making this up, this hasn't happened, but a recall of, in brackets, product you recognize, but you don't know that it's attached to this bigger, you know, scandal, catastrophe. That's going on elsewhere. You know, it's all in this. It's not connected to anything, and I just find it the continued lack of making the wires touch. I mean, it's almost a commitment to keep the wires from touching, and that.
Well, it takes work to make the connections. I mean, the old adage of connecting the dots, drawing the full picture by connecting the dots. Is a journalist's job, but it is a job. It's hard work. It takes effort. It takes money. And of course, as you know, newsrooms have less and less in the way of resources to do any kind of original reporting. And this kind of connection making is one of the first things that goes. Stories that fit neatly into some trough are the ones that tend to get to the fore.
Yeah, and I would just think that. I don't know why. I don't know. Is it just a race to do the same six? Is there? I want to think that there are editors and people, you know, even on a cable news, sitting out there going, "Okay, we need to mention this," but I guess not, huh?
No, there are, and we're dealing with a profession that has its faults and also has its heroics too. But the trouble is that there is a predominance as there is in every profession, I think, and every human activity. There is such a thing as the herd instinct. There is such a thing as consensus. Sometimes you get a predominance of thinking that it gets stuck in its own tracks, and every profession is subject to it. And I fear that although it's one very dramatic set of tracks that we're stuck in now, in a large part, the world of Trump, it's kind of forgivable, or at least understandable, that newsrooms will think in this fixed fashion. And if it's got Trump's name on it, then it automatically goes to the top of the list. If it's about baby formula somewhere in the third world, then it drops to, you know, further down the running order. That's kind of inevitable. But those voices that do think differently and want to bring in the slightly more unusual stories, the stories that have importance determined by other factors than mere party politics of the United States, they will get a look in now and again. And you know, the more that we express as readers and consumers of media of all kinds, that we're fed up with the way it is, the more likely we are to get changes. And of course, we vote with our feet, or with our eyeballs, perhaps more importantly. If we, one of the things that Huffington Post was discovering in its change away from the total Wild West approach, apart from the fact that they were getting sued, is what I'm going to say, to put it bluntly, they turned back, turned newly into the winds of active professional truth-seeking journalism that doesn't rely on people's opinions only. But one of the reasons they did that is that they found that their audiences were shrinking. And that's a sign in itself. People don't want the same stuff again and again and again. There comes a point when our eyeballs do get tired and we want something that's different.
Yes, our tired eyeballs. Thank you so much, David Tereshchuk, The Media Beat.